Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading True West Magazine, March-April 2024 edition. Wyoming, Rodeos, Ranching, and Rendezvous by Candy Moulton. Plan your trip now for summer fun in Wyoming. For some people, the three R's are reading, writing, and arithmetic, but in Wyoming, they're ranching, rodeo, and rendezvous. And you will find plenty of all three on any summertime visit to the state. High school rodeos take place throughout the spring, and the college competitors converge on Casper in June for the college national finals, this year, June 9th through the 15th. While in the city, visit Fort Capster, the Werner Wildlife Museum, and the National Historic Trails Interpretive Center, or replenish your Western wardrobe at Lou Talbot Ranch Outfitters. There is a rodeo somewhere in Wyoming almost every day, and two places to visit while you are there and will almost sure to catch an arena action are Dubois, with its rodeo running from June 11th to August 20th, and Cody, where the Cody Night Rodeo, June through August, has long been a hallmark event, and where you'll often see not only top cowboys and cowgirls, but also some of the top stock as well. While in Dubois, visit the National Bighorn Sheep Interpretive Center and the National Museum of Military Vehicles, which includes one of the largest private collections of military vehicles in the country. The Wind River Historical Center provides a glimpse into the American Indian and early settlement history of the region. Cody's attractions are some of the best in the West, including the Buffalo Bills Center of the West, the Cody Heritage Museum, Dug Up Gun Museum, and the Cody Firearms Experience, where you can learn about and shoot a variety of weapons from the Old West. For decades, Wayne's Boot Shop has been an anchor store along Sheridan Avenue, just down the street from the Irma Hotel. At By Western Hands, you'll find furniture by some of Cody's master craftsmen and learn more about their work and accompanying exhibits. Cody Songwriters is a growing September attraction, and the Chamberlain Inn is known for its patio concerts throughout the summer. Buffalo Bill Cody founded the town that carries his name, but he recruited men to perform in his Wild West in Sheridan. Rodeo action takes place at the Sheridan WYO Rodeo, July 10th through the 13th. Cowboys and visitors eat at the Cowboy Cafe or Silver Spur Cafe, or head over to the Wagon Box in Story, which has live music many nights. Sheridan's cattle country roots were established by cattlemen such as Nelson Story, who brought the first herd of Texas livestock into the area. British remittance men, those second sons of British nobility, followed and built their own cattle kingdoms. One of those ranches, established by Bradford Brenton, is home to the Brenton Museum and its outstanding collection of Western art and Plains Indian artifacts. In downtown Sheridan, you'll find King Saddlery, King Ropes, and the King Family Museum. All three are appreciated by working cowboys for the authentic gear created by the family. In 2023, Don King was recognized with the Cowboy Spirit Award from the Wyoming Cowboy Hall of Fame. Without a doubt, the king of rodeos in Wyoming is the daddy of them all. Cheyenne Frontier Days, held the last full week of July, with rodeo slack and events starting even earlier. The CFD rodeo action features the top cowboys riding for the PRCA. Among the competitors in 2023 were all-around cowboy Stetson Wright and the winningest bull rider of all time, J.B. Mauney, called the $7 million man, who competed in one of his last events before his retirement. There's a lot more than rodeo to Cheyenne Frontier Days. You'll be able to visit the Plains Indian Village with dance demonstrations held daily, free pancake breakfasts downtown, four parades featuring some of the greatest horse-drawn vehicles in the country, and night shows by top entertainers to be announced in March. Additionally, the PBR, Professional Bull Riders, will be competing in Last Cowboy Standing on July 22nd and 23rd. Refresh your cowboy wardrobe at the Wrangler, Murdoch's, Boot Barn, or just Dandy, a dandy of a store for cowgirls. Cheyenne Frontier Days Old West Museum is expanding its exhibit area and has presentations about top competitions in the CFD arena, plus a larger gift shop. Every county has a rodeo in Wyoming, and many of them have multiple events during the summer. Albany County holds Laramie Jubilee Days, July 6th through the 13th. In Carbon County, rodeo events include the Woodchoppers Jamboree and Rodeo, an event sponsored by the Lions Club since the early 1960s and held over Father's Day weekend. The Platte Valley Rodeo in Saratoga in late July, and the Carbon County Fair and Rodeo the first week in August in Rawlins. Bring on the dudes. Dude ranching started in Wyoming's Eaton Ranch at the town of Wolf, not far from Sheridan. This historic operation is still taking guests. Many other dude ranches operate in the Bighorn Mountains between Sheridan and Buffalo. These include Canyon Ranch, Double Rafter Ranch, and Paradise Guest Ranch, which offers truly unique riding experiences in the Bighorns, plus options to fly fish and participate in ranch rodeo activities. The county to the west of Cody, particularly up the north fork of the Shoshone River on the route to Yellowstone National Park, is well-known dude ranch country too, with a variety of operations that appeal to couples or families. Rimrock Ranch, the Crossed Sabres, Shoshone Ranch, and UXU are just a few of the options for a dude ranch vacation in the Cody area. Dubois and Lander also have multiple guest ranch options, many of them that combine a typical dude experience with an opportunity to do some horse packing into the wilderness for an on-the-ground stay that gets you far from people, automobiles, cell phones, and other modern amenities. Instead, you'll be close to nature and will have a chance to see some of Wyoming's high mountain country. Allen's Diamond 4 Ranch out of Lander is one of the best operations for such an adventure. CM Ranch out of Dubois offers stays at the ranch in addition to overnight pack trips. Teton County is most known as the home for the Grand Teton National Park, but there are legacy ranches in Jackson Hole, and the Jackson Hole Rodeo takes place at the end of the busy summer tourist season, August 23rd through September 2nd. This is another area where there are guest ranches for visitors to spend a week riding and learning about horses. Some of the Jackson Hole dude ranches are Triangle X, Lost Creek Ranch, Spotted Horse Ranch, Moosehead Ranch, and Double H Bar. For a dude ranch experience in southern Wyoming, visit the V Bar Guest Ranch near Centennial, the A Bar A Ranch near Encampment, or the Medicine Bow Ranch and Adventure Guest Ranch near Sarasota. For a working ranch experience in Wyoming, try the Ladder Ranch in the Little Snake River Valley, or the Hideout Lodge and Ranch near Shell. It's time for a rendezvous. The first Mountain Man Rendezvous was a small event that took place on the Black's Fork of the Green River in southwestern Wyoming in 1825. It was a gathering of mountain trappers, American Indians, and traders from St. Louis who brought supplies and goods to the people living in the mountain country. During the next 15 years, annual rendezvous took place at various locations in the northern Rocky Mountains. Six gatherings took place along the Horse Creek in the upper Green River Valley near the present town of Daniel, Wyoming. Modern-day mountain men recreate this rendezvous annually, this year July 12th through the 14th. In addition to living history camps in Traders Row, the annual event, which has been occurring for more than 85 years, includes an art show, parade, music, and vendors. A special event this year is Pinedale's 1824, The Eve of Rendezvous, a bicentennial event at the Museum of the Mountain Man, September 12th through the 15th. This is part of the National Fur Trade Symposium, which in the past has been held at Fort Laramie, Bent's Old Fork, Fort Union Trading Post, and at the Museum of the Fur Trade in Chadron, Nebraska. In addition to presentations by fur trade historians, the symposium will include auto tours to fur trade sites. The Teton County Fairgrounds is the location for the Jackson Hole Rendezvous, May 20th through the 30th. This is one of the annual events that really kicks off summer in Jackson Hole. You'll see the Mountain Men in the annual Memorial Day Parade that makes its way around the Jackson Town Square, and you can visit their camp to do some trading of your own. The 1838 Mountain Man Rendezvous is held in Riverton, July 3rd through the 7th, on the site of the original 1838 Rendezvous. That same year, some mountain men gathered beside the Grand Encampment River, then called Potter's Fork, and held a smaller rendezvous at a place they called Camp Le Grande. The The name of this gathering ultimately was used for the town of Grand Encampment, and each year, Black Powder Shooting Competition, Trader's Row, and Mountain Stories are part of the Sierra Madre Muzzle Loaders Rendezvous, which takes place adjacent to the Grand Encampment Museum in late July. By far the biggest rendezvous in the Rocky Mountain West is held over Labor Day weekend at Fort Bridger. This location is not too many crow miles away from the first mountain man gathering, and it is at the site that became important during the 19th century as a gathering spot after mountain men Jim Bridger and Luis Vasquez opened a trading post to serve travelers heading to Oregon and California. Hundreds of mountain men reenactors, American Indians, traders, and trappers take part in this rendezvous, where you can hear the music of the mountain trade by performers such as Many Strings, find hand-forged goods, trade for supplies, and explore the replica trading post established by Bridger or the authentic buildings at Fort Bridger. True West Magazine, March-April 2024. The Main Street of Montana History by Bill Yenny. Discover the treasure state along its historic highway of history. In Big Sky Country, northwestern Montana may contain the ice-capped splendor of the crown of the continent in Glacier National Park, while northeastern Montana has the grandeur of the Missouri River breaks. But the 600-mile swath across all of southern Montana is the main street of Montana history. This street is actually many roads, a scattering of roots and branches that sink deep into the past, but which also reach fresh leaves into the present. The trunk load is I-90, running from Idaho to Billings and continuing on I-94 to North Dakota. Much of the eastern half parallels the Yellowstone River itself, a important icon of Montana history. Unfolding our roadmap, we begin on the left, departing I-90 to head south on U.S. 93 along the Bitterroot River to Lolo and Travelers Rest State Park. The travelers were Lewis and Clark, and this is one of the only places where their exact, precise position is confirmed. The other is Pompey's Pillar National Monument, also in Montana, and described below. Their expedition rested at Traveler's Rest in 1805 before heading west across the Bitterroot Mountains and again eastbound in 1806. Fact, Lewis and Clark spent more time traveling and covered more miles under the big sky than in any other state. Historic Southwest. Continuing south on U.S. 93 for 85 miles, we cross the Continental Divide and head east on Mountain 43 for 16 miles to the Big Hole National Battlefield. Here on August 9th and 10th, 1877, the Army tried and failed to stop about 750 Nez Perce people, civilians and warriors. The U.S. government had promised the Nez Perce that they would be secure in their traditional homeland in Oregon, but settlers had crowded in. Led by the legendary Chief Joseph, they decided to seek asylum in Canada. The U.S. Army lost a series of battles before finally halting their progress in northern Montana after a 1,200-mile pursuit. One can walk the battlefield and visit an excellent interpretive museum. Eastbound on Mountain Road 43 and secondary S-278, a drive of 60 miles, takes today's traveler to Bannack State Park. Now officially a ghost town, Bannack was once a gold rush boom town that served for 9 months in 1864 and 1865 as Montana's first territorial capital. The notorious Henry Plummer, the sheriff who moonlighted as a bandit gang leader, was active here until he ran afoul of the vigilantes. Period buildings still exist, and many can be visited. Tours are led from the visitor center during summer months and Bannack days with reenactments and other activities that take place in July. From Bannack, we head east and north on secondary 278 and Main Road 41 and Main Road 278, deeper into the early gold rush history of Montana. Dillon, now a substantial college town, grew out of a series of gold and silver rushes that continued for around 80 years from 1862. Today, Twin Bridges is world famous as the place where the R.L. Winston Rod Company manufactures its legendary fly rods. This is a reminder that Gold Rush, Montana is part of a historic timeline that includes the region's current status as one of the best places for fly fishing in the country. Virginia City, Montana's territorial capital from 1865 to 1875, was founded in 1863 after a gold strike that swelled the population to 10,000 by 1865. As the boom faded, Virginia City withered, but interest in restoration spawned the Virginia City Historic District in 1966. Today, there are many 1860s buildings to visit, including Stonewall Hall, which housed the territorial legislature from 1865 to 1875. Summertime reenactments, theater productions, and opportunities to pan for gold are enjoyed by visitors. The Thomas Francis Meagher residence was home to the colorful Irish revolutionary and American Civil War general, who later served as acting governor of Montana. Not only can you see it, you can spend the night there by booking through Airbnb. Crossroads of Rivers. North for 80 miles on Main Highway 287 is Three Forks, named for the confluence of the three rivers which flow together here to form the Missouri River. All part of the fly fisherman's paradise in this part of Montana, the Jefferson, Madison, and Gallatin were named at by Lewis and Clark for the president and the secretaries of state and treasury. Visit the Missouri Headwaters State Park to see where this happens and spend the night at the historic 1910 Sacajawea Hotel at 5 North Main Street. Eastward for 30 miles on I-90, we reach Bozeman, home of Montana State University. The city shares a namesake, frontiersman John Bozeman, with the Bozeman Trail, once the main thoroughfare until 1868, between Fort Laramie and Virginia City. My recommended steakhouse, whether you're hungry for Montana beef or Montana bison, is the Open Range at 241 East Main Street. Billings, the largest city in Montana for over half a century, overlooks the Yellowstone River, on which steamboats were arriving here all the way from the Gulf of Mexico 150 years ago. Contemplating early Montana history, I used to dine at the steakhouse in the Rex Hotel, an old West spot often frequented by the likes of Will James and Buffalo Bill. It closed in 2017 after 107 years, but 2 years later, it was reinvented on the same site as the Buffalo Block Steakhouse. Check it out at 2401 Montana Avenue or go next door to 2403 where the Rainbow Bar, an old-time watering hole, has been in the same family since 1935. Little Bighorn Country. Southeasterly on I-90 from Billings for 63 miles brings us the most famous battlefield in the U.S. west of the Mississippi and north of the Alamo. On June 25th, 1876, Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer and about 600 men, mainly of the U.S. 7th Cavalry Regiment, attacked an encampment of approximately 7,000 Lakotas and Cheyennes here, suffering a staggering defeat. Custer and all of his 210 men under his direct command were among around 260 of the attackers who lost their lives. The defenders lost perhaps four dozen. The area is now preserved as the Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument. A self-guided driving tour of about 6 miles is highly recommended. Also recommended is a stop at Custer Battlefield Trading Post and Cafe at 347 U.S. 212. Adjacent to the National Monument entrance. Proprietor Putt Thompson offers hearty dining and a store with an old-time trading post atmosphere, selling souvenirs of all price points up to high-end American Indian fine arts, textiles, and antiques. As this is the heart of the 3,600-square-mile Crow Indian Reservation, one may wish to time a visit for the third week of August in order to take in the festivities of the annual Crow Fair, the largest American Indian gathering on the Northern Plains. Driving eastward from Billings on I-94 for 30 miles, we spy a 150-foot limestone outcropping near the southern bank of the Yellowstone River, which William Clark observed and named Pompey's Pillar, after his nickname for the 18-month-old son of Sacagawea. Clark did more than name the pillar. He climbed it and carved his name and the date, July 25th, 1806. This, the only known graffiti left by the Lewis and Clark expedition, is the centerpiece of Pompeii's Pillar National Monument. A walking trail takes visitors to view Clark's handiwork. Eastward on I-94, following the Yellowstone for 113 miles, we reach Miles City, longtime cowtown, now calling itself the cow capital of the world. The city grew out of an army post established by General Nelson Miles in 1876. A major center of the cattle industry since the 1880s, Miles City hosts the annual Eastern Montana Fair and Rodeo in August, and the world-famous Miles City Bucking Horse Sale each May. Helena. It was fun to grow up in a state where the main street in the state capital was named Last Chance Gulch. Helena, like Montana's earlier territorial capitals, grew out of a gold rush settlement. Two became ghost towns, while Helena became the state capital in 1889. Gold was discovered in 1864 in Last Chance Gulch, where the road was named Main Street, as Helena grew into a city. It was not until 1953 that the city fathers, in a moment of boosterism, retro-renamed it Last Chance Gulch. So it remains. Still, the heart of Helena, the Gulch, is an inviting place to stroll amid historic buildings, and a segment is pedestrian only. I always stop in at Aunt Bonnie's Books at 419 North Last Chance Gulch. When in the mood to kick back, I cross the street to number 406 to join fun-loving locals at the Gold Bar and Western Bar, two bars in one, for dining, libation, pool tables, and a hint of what a good experience in a bar might have been like in 1907 when the place was founded. Also visit the Montana Historical Society at 225 North Robert Street. Their museum is a wonderland of historical, archaeological, and ethnological artifacts, as well as fine art. They have one of the best collections of C.M. Russell artwork anywhere. On the hill across the street is the majestic Montana State Capitol building, completed in 1902. The guided tour includes a look at Russell's masterpiece, Lewis and Clark Meeting the Flathead Indians at Ross's Hole, 1912. Measuring 25 feet wide, it dominates the House of Representatives chamber. True West Magazine Archives, March 1989 edition. My First General Roundup by Reuben B. Mullins. Editor's note, this is the second of two chapters excerpted from Pulling Leather by Reuben B. Mullins, a new book from High Plains Press, Glendo, Wyoming. In the first chapter, Mullins arrived in Wyoming a greenhorn and soon witnessed a fatal shooting and subsequent lynching. Now, after a winter in the East, Mullins has returned to Wyoming, determined to become a real cowboy. With the help of his new cowpuncher acquaintance, Sam Mathers, he has landed a job with the AU-7 outfit and is about to take part in his first general roundup. Mr. Crawford ordered Kurt Spaw, the OS foreman, to take 40 men up the river and drive out that country. Another foreman had ordered to take a similar number and go down the river and drive up. Still another foreman had ordered to take 70 men and drive Lance Creek. Presently, all those men were racing in the different directions over the country, leaving only the roundup foreman on the ground. When all these men were properly distributed, there would be a cordon of men around a section of country 25 miles across in any direction, from which nothing could escape being driven in. Old Blue and I managed to get off with Kurt Spaw's drive, but to keep up with him and the procession, well, that's another story. Kurt looked like a mighty intelligent fellow, but when he lit out on a keen run and kept it up for 12 miles, I wasn't so sure but what he was nutty. While the horde of cowboys were at his heels at the start, many dropped back for the simple reason that their horses couldn't keep up. On and on, that wild cowboy flew over the country, sagebrush flats, ditches, prairie dog towns, up and downhill, never slackening his speed, and I thought most of the men were doomed for a tumble. Blue and I experienced plenty of trouble trying to keep in sight of the racing cowboys, but despite our best efforts, we constantly dropped behind, Notwithstanding Blue was doing his best, aided by my sharp spurs, Blue's sides were turning red due to the jabs I constantly gave him as I feared I'd lose the gang. Despite our best efforts, we were a mile behind at the finish. Presently, I came up to the cowboys, who had all dismounted and were taking a smoke while their horses were getting their second wind. I'll admit I was short on experience, as I'd hardly started to learn. Just the same, I dismounted and lit my pipe. This halt was just the customary thing, as the horses must rest and be re-cinched, ready for the second spasm. Taking a look at Blue's cinch, I found it hung an inch from his belly, and it's a wonder the saddle hadn't turned with me. I noticed Kurt gave Blue a caustic look, then quietly told me to remain with him as my horse might set me a foot off in the hills trying to follow those crazy punchers. Of course, I was green, but I was going to be much wiser before we reached camp, and as I knew Kurt was the boss, I did as he told me to. All being rested and re-cinched, the second spasm was started by sending an older puncher with 15 men to the South Divide, while another took the same amount of men and lit out for the North Divide, the remainder of the bunch remaining right there until the cattle commenced to come into the river bottom. The leader to the South Divide lit out on the run for the divide, riding as straight as he could, and every little while he dropped off a man who remained right there until the cattle commenced coming down off the divide. This continued until they reached the divide, where contact was made with the men driving Lance Creek. The leaders headed down the divide, turning every cow either toward the river or Lance Creek. As these cattle commenced coming off the divide, the men dropped off would pick them up and push them along to the next man, who would shove them on. Presently, a line of cattle extending from the divide to the river were coming in. At this time, Kurt and his bunch of men commenced to gather the cattle from both sides of the river and to drive toward the roundup ground. There were many young calves coming in with the cattle, and before we had driven 5 miles, we had hundreds of cows and calves milling amongst the drags. Soon the calves became lost from their mothers in this milling mass, which caused a fearful mess. As we progressed, the herd became larger every moment, while the dust kicked up by, the cattle slowly moving the herd along like a thick fog all over. By this time, Old Sol had risen into the sky, and the higher it rose, the hotter it became, causing every man to strip almost to the skin and tie his garments on the saddle. As we continued progressing, our herd grew larger, the dust thicker, and the heat more fearful. It became so hot it seemed that blisters would be burned on our backs, yet we must continue punching cows and calves toward the roundup ground, regardless of personal suffering from heat and thirst. There were hundreds of calves, and each calf had a mother from which it had become separated, which created a condition of milling and bawling herd to overcome. The old cows would mill through the drags, smelling each calf, each hoping to find her own, while each calf would hustle around, hunting its mother, but to find each other. Well, it couldn't be done. Naturally, this mixture made up the drags and driving them to the place where the tenderfeet earned their 35 per month. Calves would break out of the herd and run back, thinking perhaps their mothers were behind. Then some puncher would have a fast race. At times, a cowboy would be obligated to rope and drag a calf back to the herd, no matter if it did scrape the skin from its sides on the sagebrush and cactus. Experienced punchers would loosen their slickers and ride back and forth behind the herd, shanking them, which stimulated the calves to move on. Other punchers would make small loops in their ropes and practice heel roping. These ropers had two objects in view. It stimulated the calves to move on, and it gave them needed practice at heel roping. When we were obliged to cross a stream of water, the leaders wouldn't stop to take a drink, even though they were famished with thirst. Plunging into the stream, they would poke their heads up and start upstream, and it seemed an impossible task to stop them. To do so, the older men would get in front of them and fire their pistols near their noses, which usually had the desired effect. As our herd moved toward the roundup on this first drive, we were famished with thirst, yet we dared not leave the herd to hunt a drink of water. This experience proved romantic in the extreme, and very different from those of the cowboys pictured on movie screens of today. Often while watching such productions screened as are now produced of cowboys, I wonder if the writer ever saw 50 head of cattle together in one bunch. Before reaching the roundup ground with our herd, I had nearly resolved to jump my job, as there were a lot of things I'd rather do than punch drags all over a dusty hot trail. As our herd neared camp, the circle contracted, and presently all the men were with the cattle. Eventually, we drove our herd onto the roundup ground, and after Mr. Crawford showed us where he wished the herd placed, we scooted for our camp as fast as our tired horses would go. What was true of this drive was, in a general way, true of all the others, and by the time all the drives were in, there must have been over 8,000 cattle on the roundup ground. On reaching camp, it was remarkable how quickly the punchers hit the ground and unsaddled their horses. With equal alacrity, the boys gulped down quarts of water, trying to quench their thirsts. No time was lost in filling our 10 plates out of those Dutch ovens, which were full of red-hot food. It was an unwritten law that this meal must be eaten in a hurry, as there were hungry and thirsty men holding the cattle who had a great desire to be relieved. As soon as a man finished eating, he grabbed his rope and caught his saddle horse, then away to the herd, and what a joy to those punchers left with the cattle to see him coming. In the fewest possible minutes, those thirsty and hungry punchers were in camp, putting away that belated meal, while other punchers were catching out their fresh horses and saddling them so that no time would be lost. Reaching the herds, it was found that Jim had reserved two bunches of cattle for our two outfits to start in on. The cattle from both herds were cut into one bunch, which facilitated the work all through the roundup. The cows and calves were cut out first, then the dry stock was cleaned out. And after the reps looked through the herds, we were ready for the next bunch. In this way, the work went forward until every herd in the roundup had been worked. Then after a change to fresh horses, boys in sufficient numbers were sent to drive our starting herd to the next roundup ground, perhaps 20 miles away. Harry had his horses conveniently close at the end of the work. Then all hands caught out their road horses and jolted along to the next campground, while some would help Harry drive his herd of horses. Long ago, Fred had broken camp and driven to the next one, and by this time, he would be preparing supper. Notwithstanding that we were all shot when we got off that first drive, I was to learn that plenty of water and a good meal under our belts did more to cause a comeback, especially when mounted on a fresh horse, than any other thing. Jim, acting as roundup foreman, had no time to run his own cow outfit, so this part was turned over to his brother, Arch, who was a splendid cowman. What our outfit did was duplicated by all the other outfits, and when all were finished, the remaining cattle were left on the ground to drift wheresoever they wished. On reaching the new camp, the punchers had no time to flop down on their beds and rest, for after eating supper, they must catch their night horses, and several of them would trail back to meet the herd and relieve those men. As the shades of evening covered the earth, our herd was rounded in on a level piece of ground near camp and held there until morning. To hold the cattle, men in sufficient number were named to stand the four reliefs and hold the cattle on the bed ground. Reliefs were divided into four periods. The first went on after supper and stood until 10. The second went out at 10 and stood until 12. While the last relief herded the cattle from 2 until relieved by the day herders. After a riper experience, I learned that singing was an important factor in keeping the cattle quiet. It mattered little what the song or tune was, just as long as it was kept going. It seemed there was something about the noise the punchers call singing that had a soothing influence on the cattle's nerves. Especially was this true with the beef cattle. It seemed that this class of cattle just loved the vocal efforts of the punchers. Often, I have seen, while on night guard, that if the boys let up on the singing or mumbling, then some old beef steer would rise to his feet and turn around a time or two, and, if the singing was resumed, he'd lie down. On the other hand, if the singing wasn't resumed, that same steer might give a snort And as quick as lightning, the entire herd would be on their feet and racing all over the country in what tenderfeet call a stampede. At first, it seemed to me the singing was more for the purpose of keeping the puncher awake than of keeping the cattle quiet. Yet, with a riper experience, I found this was not true, as our vocal efforts really had a quieting influence on the cattle. The hours for work on a roundup were rotten, from 3 a.m. until we could roll up in our blankets in the evening. Then 2 hours for night guard between times. With this loss of sleep, is it a wonder how we could possibly keep awake? Standing night guard, there was a well-trained horse that came in handy. With such a horse, one could train himself to sleep holding on to the saddle horn while the horse trotted around the herd. A puncher knowing the capabilities of his horse could rest assured that the horse would see any animal leaving the herd, and he would be right after him without orders from the rider. After having trained myself to put on this stunt, I have but had my neck unjointed by my horse, giving a sudden spring after some absconding cow or steer. During black stormy nights, night guard was hazardous, as a good night horse cared nothing about the darkness or the contour of the ground when he saw some cow leaving the herd, and he would be cut out like a pistol ball. True West Magazine Archives, March 1989 edition. They Raided Nogales by Harold L. Edwards. The rebels quietly crossed the international boundary into Mexico near Nogales. At the outskirts of the city, they rested 30 minutes and then entered the town. Before attacking the customs house, the insurgents fired their weapons randomly and yelled, "Viva Santa Teresa! Viva Santa Teresa!" Santa Teresa and the Mexican Insurrection of 1896. Singly, and by twos and threes, they slipped into Arizona from Mexico and met at Tubac, where they completed last-minute plans to return to their homeland and forcefully overthrow the government of Porfirio Diaz. They had the will and the zeal, and they were totally convinced that their cause was sanctioned and blessed by Santa Teresa. Santa Teresa Urrera was a long-considered person by the officials of the Mexican government to be a political agitator. In 1891, she was arrested by the Mexican authorities for inciting an uprising among the Yaqui Indians. After a brief time in custody, Santa Teresa was banned from Mexico with her father, Don Tomas Urrea. They then made their home in El Paso, Texas. The Yaquis were infuriated by the government's decision and threatened to go on the warpath. To calm the tense situation, the governor of Sonora relented and invited Santa Teresa back to Cabora. She returned to her home there in 1893. Shortly after her return to Sonora, the Indians again gathered about their saint. Government officers, sensing that civil strife and disorder could recur, once more ordered Teresa and her father out of the country. This time, the exiles made their home in Clifton, Arizona, where for the next several years, Teresa tried to disengage herself from revolutionary activities south of the border. The Raid on Nogales would be the high point of the Santa Teresa movement. The insurgents meeting at Tubac were like all fledgling revolutionaries. They were poverty-stricken and desperately needed money, weapons, and ammunition to even start their armed movement. The Mexican customs house in Nogales contained those supplies, and therefore would be the object of their first raid. The plan was simple. After capturing the customs house, the victorious insurgents would conduct a popular march through Sonora and on to Mexico City. Converts would be enlisted along the way, and other government arsenals and supply depots would be looted to arm and feed the revolutionary troops. In the end, Mexico City would be entered and the government overthrown. A new government would be established, which would be more sensitive to the needs of the common people. Indeed, the poor Mexicans and Indians of northern Mexico reflected the sentiments of the oppressed lower classes of all Mexico. Even prior to 1890, the rumblings of discontent and the winds of revolution had been felt throughout the nation. The leaders of the Santa Teresa movement had been organizing since 1891, and by August of 1896, they felt the time was right for action. On the night of August 11th, under the leadership of José Gómez, the rebels, numbering about 75 stalwarts, moved south from Tubac and quietly crossed the international boundary into Mexico near Nogales. At the outskirts of the city, they rested 30 minutes and then entered the town. Before attacking the customs house, the insurgents fired their weapons and randomly shouted in the streets, "Viva Santa Teresa! Viva Santa Teresa!" The city sprang to life as the rebels launched their attack against the government building. About 4 a.m. on August 12th, several rebel soldiers entered the customs building. The guards had been surprised, but they quickly rallied and drove the invaders out into the street after a hot fight. Citizens now began shooting at the darting figures in the streets. The rebels returned the fire. In the meantime, the town was further aroused by someone who rang the fire bell. Soon, more armed and agitated citizens entered the fray. The sounds of the fighting also alerted the residents in the United States portion of Nogales. A number of those men armed themselves and hurried across the border to join the action. A couple of them were intercepted by the Santa Teresas. The prisoners were told that the rebels had no quarrel with Americans or the United States, but only with the Mexican government. The captives were disarmed and ordered to return to their homes. American Nogales prepared for the worst. Citizens armed, and a call went to the United States government to send troops to Nogales to protect the city from forays from Mexico. The tide of battle turned against the attackers, and they slowly retreated out of the town's west end and into the hills, leaving behind seven dead and several wounded. In addition, several of their number were taken prisoner. Customs House guards Manuel Delante and Francisco Fernandez were killed in the government house engagement. Police officer Manuel Peña and citizen Presencio Urbina were slain in the street fighting. Other townsmen were wounded. For the moment, Nogales would take a breather. Immediately after the rebels retreated, Nogales police captain Ponciano Sanchez, a gentleman of courage, mounted a posse of four hardy men and pursued the bandits in hopes of locating them for the reinforcements which were sure to arrive. About 5 miles west of the city, Captain Sanchez's posse was ambushed. The officer was beaten to death with rifle butts and slashed with machetes when his horse was shot and fell to the ground. Juan Fernandez, a clerk at the customs house and a brother of the slain guard, was also killed. The other posse men escaped and returned to Nogales with the sad news. Another posse was hastily formed and the group of 20 men rode to the scene of the ambush. The bodies of Sanchez and Fernandez were recovered without incident. Responding to the frantic calls for protection, the United States Army rushed two companies of troops to American Nogales. Other troops patrolled the border areas to prevent insurgents from entering United States territory. Also, within hours of the raid, Colonel Emilio Kostolitsky arrived in Nogales with 60 of his crack-mounted police officers. He and his troops immediately took to the field. Kostolitsky's campaign was vigorous. He drove some of the bandits southward, killing several of them and capturing a few others. But most of the attackers dispersed after the defeat at Nogales and melted into the countryside. Some recrossed the border into the United States, where they blended into the local Hispanic population. For several days, tension remained high on both sides of the international line. It was even reported that Tucson might be attacked by uprising Indians. A deserter from the United States Army came into Tucson and informed its citizens that the Army had collided with a group of 23 of the Nogales raiders on the Arizona side of the line. The insurgents opened fire on the troops, and the soldiers shot back. Three Indians were killed, and the remaining rebels surrendered. The story was published in several newspapers before it was determined to be a hoax. The deserter, however, was real, and he was arrested and held for the army. Stories such as that only added to the panic and the confusion. However, American troops did capture three Yaqui Indians whom they held for the Mexican authorities. On August 23rd, Mexican government troops fought a sharp battle with the bandits, or rebels, in the mountain country across the Rio Grande from Presidio, Texas. One soldier and three bandits were killed. The insurgents were forced to give ground, and when the news of this action was received on the Texas side of the boundary, people feared the destitute bandits would raid their area. Presidio County Sheriff Dan Knight crossed the river and met with Mexican military officers who momentarily expected an attack from the revolutionists. Returning to Presidio, Sheriff Knight announced to the press that the situation was serious and that insurgents might enter the United States as raiders. He called on Texas Ranger Captain John Hughes to send forces into the region for added protection. The fanatics did not attack the federal forces as expected, nor did they enter Texas as a group. The crisis passed. The rebel forces across the border from Texas confirmed that they were part of the army that had attacked Nogales earlier. Ascension Rodriguez, a leader of the rebels, had been captured in Chihuahua by government forces. At Ojinaga on the Rio Grande, he was stood against the wall and shot. Within a few weeks, the Santa Teresa movement lost its momentum and died a natural death. The Mexican authorities had little doubt that Teresa Urrea and her father were directly involved in the Nogales raid. Many people had heard that the attackers yelling Viva Santa Teresa during the fighting. One Yaqui insurgent had been carrying her picture when he was killed. Another dead Indian rebel was found to have two unsigned letters which officials believed incriminated Teresa. One of them stated, "Trust in God and your expedition will be a success." The other said, "Money, guns, and ammunition are ready to go to the Yaqui River." The first letter was dated June 26, 1896. The second, July 25, 1896. Several insurgents had copies of the Independiente, a revolutionary journal published in El Paso, Texas, by Loro Aguirre, an ardent foe of the Diaz regime. Mexican officials believed that Aguirre had great influence over Don Tomas and, indirectly, over Teresa. At the time of the Nogales raid, Teresa and her father were residing in the United States. Nevertheless, the Mexican government made it quite clear that they were wanted in Mexico on charges of insurrection against the government. American officials, however, concluded that there was no proof that Teresa and her father were actively involved in the Nogales raid. Since the Urreas were living quietly and causing no disruptions in the United States, no action was taken on the Mexican government's request. The Mexican government then asked the United States government to keep the Urreas family at least 200 miles inland from the border. Don Tomas and his daughter continued to deny that they had any connection with revolutionary forces and movements in Mexico or any involvement in the Nogales raid. They were allowed continued freedom of movement in the United States. With the raid on Nogales, Santa Teresa was propelled by the press into national prominence. The public was fascinated by this female saint who could lead revolutionary movements and have fanatic and devoted followers. Who was Santa Teresa? Where did she come from? And where did she get her political powers? Teresa Urrea was born in Sinaloa, Mexico, to an unwed Indian girl named Secatana Chavez. Her father, Tomas Urrea, was from a local family of substance. Teresa resided with her mother in poverty and hardship until she was about 16 years of age. Then her father acknowledged her and took her into his home, where she was well-treated and received good care, but no education. Sometime after going to live with her father, she went into a trance, a coma, or some sort of spell. The condition continued for several weeks. When she awakened, she was convinced that she had extraordinary powers. She went among the local Indians and talked to them of God, not church, but God. She also found that if she touched or rubbed the sick, they would be cured. Her reputation for innate goodness and for spiritual healing powers spread rapidly among the local Mexicans and Indians. They revered her, obeyed her, and called her Santa Teresa. Of course, it was inevitable that the downtrodden Yaquis and others would find in her the inspirational leader for their revolutionary movement. Her popularity among the discontented caused uneasiness among government officials who were highly sensitive to anti-government activities. To make matters worse, it seemed that any time Teresa drew a crowd, violence occurred and police problems resulted. This confirmed officialdom's suspicions about her, and ultimately, she was ordered out of the country. While Teresa and her father lived in El Paso, Texas, she continued and expanded her good works. Her reputation for healing the sick among the poor and the destitute widened. She was approached by Dr. A.G. Huff, who had been a practicing physician in San Francisco. He asked her to go on a theater tour as a star attraction. It was reported in the press that Teresa agreed with the offer and would be billed as Santa Teresa, the Sonoran Witch. On August 27, 1896, the San Francisco Call stated Santa Teresa to be a freak, the mystical Mexican as a star theatrical attraction. Dr. Huff conceived the idea as a moneymaker during Teresa's widely publicized involvement with the recent revolutionary activities south of the border. Naturally, Dr. Huff would be her manager and advisor. However, it appears that the deal was not consummated, and Teresa did not go on the road at that time. Teresa and her father finally settled in Clifton, Arizona. She continued her faith healing and administering to the poor. She spent much time discussing God with the local Hispanic population, and her saintly reputation continued to grow. After the Nogales raid, and with the fading of Santa Teresa revolutionary movement, Teresa disappeared from the American headlines. However, she wasn't forgotten in Mexico, and Mexican authorities made it clear that she was not welcome in that country. As Teresa continued her administrations, a local physician noticed her power and methods of healing the sick. He became convinced that she was not a quack, and he even referred some of his own patients to her for treatment. Dr. L.A.W. Birch didn't understand how Teresa did it, but was impressed by her notable success rate. Dr. Birch testified to Teresa's good works, and he enhanced her reputation to such a point that she also treated patients as far away as San Jose, California. In 1900, Teresa married Guadalupe Rodriguez. He was a local laborer and certainly not a man of means. Don Tomas objected to the match, not only for that reason, but also because he felt that Lupe was mentally unstable and had the potential for violence. His feelings were prophetic. Teresa and her husband spent their wedding night dancing with their friends. Guadalupe imbibed freely. The next morning, he informed his astonished wife that they were immediately returning to Mexico. Teresa demurred, saying that she couldn't go to Mexico, as she would be arrested by the Mexican authorities and probably shot. Lupe insisted, and finally, Teresa agreed to accompany him to Sonora. Teresa's friends begged her not to make the trip as she walked along behind her husband at the beginning of their journey. Her friends continued to follow them, and Lupe suddenly increased his pace until his wife couldn't keep up with him. As she fell back, he turned around, drew a pistol, and fired at her. The bullet missed, but Teresa fell into the roadway. Lupe fled into the nearby brush as Teresa's friends escorted her back to her father's home. The assault was reported to local peace officers who initiated a search for the assailant. They found him, and he resisted arrest by firing all of the cartridges in his pistol at them. The officer shot back, but no one was hit. Out of ammunition, Lupe surrendered. Teresa visited him at the jail, and she was shocked when, even there, he threatened to kill her. Lupe was eventually committed to an asylum, and Teresa ultimately divorced him. Teresa and her father were convinced that Guadalupe was an agent of the Mexican government and that he had the mission of enticing her back to that country. If that failed, they speculated, he was to kill her. He may have felt that her friends were convincing her to remain in the United States while they were walking down the road. Teresa was again approached to go on tour. This time the offer was from a medical company which may have been another name for a theatrical enterprise. She believed that the tour would give her the opportunity to bring her talents to more people, and she consented to go. Teresa spoke little English, so during her tours, John Van Order was her interpreter. They married and ultimately had two daughters. In the meantime, in 1902, Don Tomas died in Arizona. With family responsibilities, Teresa felt it was best to return to Clifton and reestablish her home. She had done well financially on her tours. With her money, she constructed a comfortable two-story house and thereafter lived a reasonably secure life. Teresa was free of the political turmoil in Mexico and, for a time, of other worries. She rededicated herself to alleviating the suffering of the sick and to help others in a spiritual way. However, it was discovered that she was suffering from a disease of the lungs. She was treated by her old friend, Dr. Birch, but the illness progressed and ultimately proved fatal. She died on January 11th, 1906. Her remains were interred in the Catholic cemetery in Clifton. Teresa Urrea's lasting contribution to the history of the United States-Mexican border country is as a saintly person dedicated to the betterment of the poor and the sick. While she was reported to be an ardent and violent revolutionary and the spiritual and actual leader of the rebelling Yaqui Indians, it appears that she was not. She and her father may have been used to promote certain causes by shrewd individuals such as Lauro Aguirre. In the end, however, the Urreas seem to have been victims of circumstance rather than the actual perpetrators of insurgents against the Mexican government. The Santa Teresa movement flared briefly, culminating with the raid on Nogales, and died away. But the seeds of discontent and the winds of revolution were sweeping Mexico. Soon, pragmatic leaders would merge to direct the movements. Dedicated fighting men would join the ranks, and they would not rely on fanatical spiritual support, but on promises of justice and of land reform. The Diaz regime was toppled in 1911, and for several years thereafter, the country was torn asunder by revolutions and counter-revolutions. Finally, the revolutions of 1910 ended, and Mexico began pulling itself together. However, Santa Teresa did not live to see those events. Her involvement in revolutionary activities and the raid on Nogales were overshadowed by the later and larger developments. In the end, they are all but forgotten. Today, the Santa Teresa movement, Teresa Urrea, and the raid on Nogales in 1896 are only footnotes in the troubled history of the United States-Mexican border.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.